From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In February of 2008, 14-year-old Brandon McInerney shot and killed 15-year-old Larry King in the computer class at a school in Oxnard, California. A few days earlier, Larry, who was described as flamboyant, who regularly dressed as a girl, had asked Brandon to be his Valentine. For some people, it's easier to care about Larry than Brandon. Larry was the victim, after all. But the filmmaker Marta Cunningham says Brandon is also a victim. And in her documentary, Valentine Road, she treats them both as protagonists. Both had a troubled upbringing, neither of them were fully formed, and in both cases, the adults in their lives failed them. Today in the program, we continue our series on documentaries. Marta Cunningham is joining us to work through the layers in this complicated story. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here are the basics of the story. It's February 2008, a couple of days before Valentine's Day, and in the computer class of a school in Oxnard, California, Brandon McInerney, who had just turned 14, pulls a gun out of his hoodie and shoots 15-year-old Larry King in the head, twice. A few days before that, Larry, who has been described as flamboyant, who regularly dressed as a girl, had approached Brandon while he was playing basketball with some friends and asked him to be his Valentine. Now, if you look at the basics, it's easier to feel sympathy for Larry, who died that day. Larry was an outcast who had embraced his sexual identity and was taking on the ridicule. Brandon, on the other hand, was seen as sullen and violent, homophobic to be sure, possibly a racist. But the filmmaker Marta Cunningham saw more layers in this story. In her documentary, Valentine Road, she treats them both as protagonists. Both had a troubled upbringing, and in both of their cases, the adults in their lives, when given the chance to help them, mostly failed. Today in the program, we continue our series on documentaries. We're talking about Valentine Road, a film that premiered at Sundance this year. Marta Cunningham is with us to work through the layers of the complicated story and the incredibly difficult questions that it raises. You can join us if you like. If you have questions or comments, 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Marta Cunningham is a first-time filmmaker. She directed and produced Valentine Road. The film premiered, as I said, as part of this year's Sundance Film Festival in the U.S. Documentary Competition. We should also say she's an accomplished actor as well as a writer, dancer, and choreographer. I'll also say that the Utah Film Center and Radio West, we're going to be screening Valentine Road next week. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. And we should also say Marta Cunningham is joining us in Salt Lake City for that screening. And today, though, she's joining us from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. Marta Cunningham, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Doug, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I guess the first question I wanted to know is, when did you first hear the story? Was it when you read the news of what had happened that February day?
I actually read a very small excerpt in the Southwestern Poverty Law Center magazine that comes out, I think, probably quarterly. And it was just literally maybe 10 sentences, 15 sentences. And it had pictures of both of the boys. And I immediately got in touch with the homeless shelter where Larry was staying and said, I need to know more about this story. I was deeply affected by it. And I was also deeply affected that I hadn't heard more about it. Yeah. I mean, I really thought it was just overwhelmingly tragic story. And why didn't I know more about Larry? Why didn't I know more about Brandon and what was happening? It was 6 months after the actual incident.
What was it? What was that moved you? Were you thinking about Brandon at that time? I mean, the film is as much about him as that, but it would be easy to excuse you for focusing on Larry. So were you thinking of both of them at first?
At first, I have to say I wasn't.
Yeah.
I really was focused on Larry.
Yeah.
And didn't really care at all about Brandon. Mm-hmm. And I think I really wanted the audience to go through that. You've seen the film, and I wanted people to kind of go through my journey. And the journey was, honestly, I just didn't care about Brandon. And it really shocks me now, you know, 5 years later, even saying that out loud, but it's true. Yeah. I really didn't start feeling for Brandon until I sat through those hearings. And when I sat in an adult courtroom and saw this gangly 14-year-old, I thought, why is he in here? Mm. And how is it fair that the state of California is trying this 14-year-old boy as an adult?
Yeah.
And he's looking at 53 years to life without the chance of parole. How is that right?
You know, it's interesting. The first image we see in the film of Brandon is him staring into the camera, and he looks really menacing. And it made me think about just how easy it would have been, or maybe how easy it is for the media and others to kind of manipulate the story, you know, depending on your point of view, which I got a sense is kind of what the film is about, it seems to me, that we all bring certain biases to any story, I guess.
That was the goal. I'm glad that you felt that way. I really was shaken and disturbed by how the media manipulated not only Larry, but Brandon, and how they really set these two children off against each other. When I did my research and I saw, really, these two kids are more similar than they're different.
Yeah.
The amount of abuse and neglect that they had gone through in their short lives on this planet, it was astounding. And I felt they're both kids. They're both children. And we have to look at who the real culprits in this story are. And it's the adults, not only in the institution where they were at, but also in society at large. We are constantly perpetuating these hateful ideas and really not taking responsibility or accountability for our thoughts, our actions. You know, children are sponges, and they absorb everything they see. So if we're putting hate out there, then they're absorbing that too.
I've seen where you've talked about the filmmakers that you like, and among them are filmmakers like Errol Morris and Jacques Audard, people who tell you, as you said, stories through anti-heroes. So it seems like you are interested more in this gray area than just oversimplifying the story, because there is certainly that. I mean, this is a story that has, you could even say Brandon in some way is an anti-hero. Do you think that's fair?
I don't know if I would go that far,
yeah.
But I do think that Brandon was easily villainized.
Yeah.
I mean, who among us is going to say that they agree with white supremacy? I mean, it's obviously an extreme notion, but why is this child reading these books?
Yeah.
And why does he believe that white people are superior intellectually, which is what he said in the courtroom in transcripts?
Mm-hmm.
Why does he feel this way? Where is he getting this information? And how is this acceptable? And I wanted to look at that. I thought this was extremely important. And I thought it was very interesting also that, you know, for whatever reason, they didn't feel it was a hate crime.
Yeah. So I want to play a clip here because I think it conveys early on this a kind of conflict, this give and take that we see throughout the film. You have on one hand kind of this full-on acceptance of Larry, and whom we'll get to, by the way. I want to spend some time with him. But Larry, who's flamboyant, and he's sort of accepting his sexual identity. And then you have on the other hand the sense, the kind of suspicion about that, that Larry's gone too far, that this is too much, it's strange. It's characterized in this clip from the film. We hear Larry's legal guardian, Tracy Carroll, here. And then we also hear this sort of counterview, which is from Brandon's girlfriend, who I want to talk about too. She's an interesting character. Her name is Sam. Here's a clip from the film, Valentine Road.
He's a tough kid, pretty strong-willed. You know, I remember telling him one time, Larry, you really shouldn't be wearing heeled shoes to school because it's, you know, it's dangerous when you're doing PE. And so he put on tennis shoes and went out the door with me. Little did I know, he had tucked his heels into a backpack.
Whenever Brandon talked about Larry, it was about what Larry was wearing, because it really was just weird. It was like off the wall to him. And it was off the wall to me, too. I think Larry was kind of shoving it in everyone's face. For you to come to school dressed like that, you're making a big statement.
Marta Cunningham, talk about that as a theme in the film, because we see this come up time and time again. You know, acceptance versus the sense of suspicion. Talk about why you dealt with this in the film.
Yeah, I think the reason I felt that my position in this was to bear witness.
Yeah.
So the family of Brandon love him, and they felt that he was getting a raw deal, and they really needed to show how they felt. That was really important to them, that their truth was told, mm-hmm. and that they had a voice. And I wanted to bear witness for them. I don't necessarily agree with the viewpoints that they had,
yeah.
but I really wanted to make sure that they had a voice in the film. My own viewpoint is not important. When it really came down to it, I needed these people to have a voice. Whether I agreed with them, whether I didn't agree with them, wasn't really the point. The point was, this is how they felt. This is how Brandon felt. This is how the family felt. And Brandon's girlfriend, friends, they felt that Larry went too far. What's interesting to me is, you know, I'm sure you saw this as well in the film, is Joy Epstein, who is the vice principal,
yeah.
says, well, actually, there's a state law that says that he's free to dress as long as it's within the boundaries of his uniform in any way that he wants.
Mm-hmm. Accessorized.
If girls wear makeup, then he can wear makeup. If girls wear bows in their hair, then he can wear bows in his hair. And if he wants to call himself Letitia, then that might be another story. I mean, but here's the thing. What's wrong with femininity? And that's really, to me, the question that I always ask, you know, my audience at the end of the film is, let's think about this for a minute. What is wrong with being feminine? Because actually, when you look at it, that's all Larry really wanted to be, was feminine. He was attracted to accessories that girls wear. And what's wrong with being a girl?
Larry creates this alter ego. There's this irony that he goes to this Casa Pacifica. It's kind of a home. How do you describe that place? It's kind of a...
It's a shelter, for neglected and abused children.
Yeah. And there he really... it seems like it's a turning point in some way for Larry. I mean, he is... he has a sense of freedom there. And this is... It seems like this is where he... From some people, you know, they raise the question of whether he had, at this point, when he now becomes, accepts who he is, did he cross a line? You know, that question comes up time and time again from some people, which we'll get to. But this idea of him finding this alter ego, finding this sense of freedom. Let me play another clip from the film. This is a friend of his who talks about how he created this alter ego, as you'll hear, as a way to kind of deal with who he was. Here's another moment from the film Valentine Road.
One day it would be LaQuisha, and then the next day LaTonya. But it always started with La. Everyone knew that Larry was part black. So it was like a generic kind of black name. You don't mess with LaToya or LaTonya. You know, you don't mess with her. At first, people didn't talk to him at all. They thought he was crazy. I think that's kind of the thing he wanted. If they didn't talk to him, they weren't bothering him. It was just kind of relief. And so that's kind of who that person was to him. It's kind of who he wished he was.
You get this sense with Brandon too. You know, these both of these kids were not fully formed, and they were still figuring out where they were going to end up. And this was the case for Larry. And what was sort of lovely about this alter ego that he had created is this was something that he had embraced, and he was finally honest to sort of say, "This is who I am." I guess.
I agree, and what's interesting as well, and this is a learning curve for me. I learned a lot about what transgender is, because yeah. what we're really talking about is gender identity and gender exploration. Right. It's not a sexual orientation. It has nothing to do with sexual orientation. So that was a real learning curve for me, because I didn't really know much about the transgender community. And, you know, I really have to thank the Gay and Lesbian Center in Los Angeles for helping me. There's so many people there who work in the trenches and the front lines of our educational system, really putting it out there in LA County of what LGBT and the T in LGBT means.
Yeah.
And what we're finding now is kids are coming out younger, and we have to be ready for that. So Larry was 15, and he, you know, from all accounts, from his friends and from the people that took care of him at Casa Pacifica, he was exploring that. And he was in within his rights. And really, when the kids told me after he was gone, and they felt guilty because they really saw that he wasn't hurting anyone. He wasn't doing anything wrong. He was just really exploring himself and was very comfortable in himself. And I admire that.
So interesting to see. And we encountered this ourselves in trying to sort of talk about, you know, to mention the story itself. It's interesting how you see gay teen, you know, gay young person, which, you know, you saw it in the media throughout. You still see it, I think, in headlines, even talking about this particular film, which I guess just expresses there is some confusion about that difference between orientation and identity, I suppose.
Definitely. And I think it was interesting because the really where it was explored, and I give a lot of credit to the prosecution, was in the courtroom. You know, they mentioned it many times that the hate crime was about gender expression. And, you know, Mae Fox, who was the acting prosecuting team, she was the head of that. She, you know, spoke about it to me at length. And I think it's a really important notion. And I think the more that we become comfortable with the language of that, the more that we'll be able to express it correctly. And I did see a lot of media coverage that talked to him, you know, spoke of him of being gay. And again, when I started this project, I didn't know myself.
Yeah.
And it was really through the transgender community and through all of the different research and interviews that I did with Casa Pacifica and with his friends that I started understanding, okay, this actually has nothing to do with sexual orientation. This is to do with identity and how he saw himself. And he was calling himself Letitia. He wanted to be called Letitia. He had changed his name, and his friends were at that point calling him Letitia. So it's really a very interesting notion. And I think that to look at this from the vantage point of who he saw himself as.
Yeah.
And that's what we wanted to convey in the film by, you know, using the animation, is this is how Larry saw himself.
Marta Cunningham is with us. She's director and producer of the documentary film Valentine Road. Next week, she's going to be joining us here in Salt Lake City for a free screening of the film. It's part of our Through the Lens series in partnership with the Utah Film Center. That's Wednesday evening, May 1st. 7 o'clock, the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. Marta Cunningham will be involved in a question and answer session after the film. Go to our website for the details, radiowest.kuer.org. We need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue our series on documentary film. Marta Cunningham is our guest. She's joining us to talk about a film she made about a school shooting in Southern California in 2008, where a flamboyant transgendered boy, Larry, was shot by a schoolmate, Brandon. There are a lot of layers in this story. The simplest telling is that a violent, hate-filled kid killed a sensitive boy because of his sexual identity. But Marta Cunningham reveals the other layers to the story. She sees both boys as victims and protagonists with troubled backgrounds. The film is called Valentine Road. We're screening it next week. Today in the program, as I said, Marta Cunningham is joining us to talk about it. One of the issues in the film is whether a boy, just barely turned 14, as you said, should be charged as an adult. And it seems like Brandon is really caught up in this bigger conflict that he has nothing to do with, you know, this matter of law and order, and he's sort of stuck there.
It's true. It's a good way to put it. He definitely is. When you take someone's life, is that an adult action, no matter if you're a child? And I think that that's an argument that we should at least open up in the state of California again. I think that it was a proposition that was couched in terms of gangs.
Yeah.
And a lot of people voted for it without realizing that this can really take place in any court in California and they can use it in any way they want. And I think it's really important to take a look at it again. It's one of the reasons why I made the film. I think that we need to open up the conversation for trying children as adults. Because in my eyes, when you're 14, you're not an adult.
Mae Fox, you mentioned, she's an interesting character in the film. On one hand, she seems, you know, pretty conservative, very much like a prosecutor, you know, all about punishing the bad guys, very much all about law and order. And she's, of course, taken on the case of Larry King. She sees him as the victim of a hate crime. And her view of Brandon is not terribly nuanced, let's say. I mean, she sees him as kind of a thug. I don't think there is one point when she says his first name, but mostly she just sort of refers to him as McInerney. Talk about Mae Fox. She's really a complicated character in the film, too.
I enjoy her as a character
because
she reveals so much of herself to us. I spent so much time with Maeve. She was one of the first people that said yes to me. Hmm. And I have to say, you know, I was first-time filmmaker. And I was like, look, I'm not going away. I'm just going to be in your courtroom every day in every hearing. And she's like, don't you have something better to do? I'm like, no, this is my next 5 years. So she really trusted and took a chance with me. And we spent hours together talking about the case and her viewpoint. What I found so incredible about her is that she really takes on an activist role almost for Larry.
Yeah.
She is really, she feels, and she says this, you know, in the film in so many ways, she's got to be the voice of the dead, of the murdered. And that is her role. And there is no room for gray in that role. And I respect that. I understand it. Because when you are in the position that she's in, she just sees black and white. And that's her job.
Right, right.
And I respected that. I mean, as a person, you know, sometimes it was hard to be around. But I respected it. That's her job. And she was fighting for Larry. 100%. There was never a moment where you feel that she's doing it for any other reason. This is for that child who was killed in the classroom. And that's all she sees.
And she's absolutely convinced, as you'll hear in this clip, that, as she says in the excerpt, that, you know, this is not a crime that the juvenile system is capable of handling, that Brandon needs to be tried as an adult. Here's another clip from Valentine Road.
There are cases where juveniles have committed a homicide and we leave them in juvenile court. Because of the vicious nature of the crime, this is not a crime that the juvenile system is capable of handling. What do you do with someone like this who is so dangerous that they plot out the execution of a classmate in front of a whole classroom full of people? What do you do with someone like that? And it's not always easy.
Marta Cunningham, do you feel like you got close to some kind of answer to the question, what do you do with someone like that?
What I felt is by making this film at least opens up the door and starts a dialogue. That was very important for me to at least pose the question to the audience, to people in states where they're trying children as adults. What do we do? Now, she's right in some ways. Is it fair for a boy who's done this to be set free in 5 years? Because that's basically what she said would probably happen. Now, she could be wrong, but most likely within 5 to 7 years, he would be walking.
Right.
And is the system set up in the state of California to handle? I think it's a great question. It's why we put it in the film. Mm-hmm. Is it set up that way? At this point in time, I don't think it is. But then why aren't we changing it? Why are we then just spending so much more money to incarcerate these young boys? How is that the answer to this? To me, that I don't feel that's the answer. So why can't we take a look at that as a state? Why can't we look at these laws and change them?
So we have Maeve Fox on one end of the spectrum. Let's talk about Robin Bransom and Scott Wippert. They become Brandon's defense lawyers, passionate defense lawyers, particularly Robin, at least the sense of that in the film. How do you describe Robin Bransom's relationship with Brandon McInerney?
Robin, I truly believe she loves Brandon, and she really relates to him on a very personal level, which I found to be true of a lot of defense attorneys that I met. They, especially Brandon being so young, they almost feel paternal, I would say.
But let me just, what was confusing for me about her connection to him is, and I don't want to sort of get a sort of knee-jerk impression of who she was, but you get a sense that Robin and Scott both are pretty liberal-thinking people. And the fact that she feels so passionate about defending this kid who is a racist, is homophobic, could be pretty violent at times, sure, had a terrible upbringing, and that plays into all of that, but that she could be so connected to him, to some pretty distasteful ideas that he had, I thought was really kind of surprising and really interesting.
I think it's really interesting as well. And it also tells you the level of understanding that they have of Brandon as the child.
Yeah.
You know, they met Brandon when he was 14, and they felt that whatever he's done is horrendous and horrible, and he should pay for that in some consequence, but not 53 years to life without the chance of parole. And they also became strong activists for children's rights. And they also have a case right now on another in Ventura County for another 14-year-old. So I think this is now their kind of what they're gearing up to do. I think they're taking on that law in as much as they can in Ventura County. Mm. They're real believers.
Let me play another clip. This is Robin Bransom here. And she gets this tattoo on her arm that says "Save Brandon." That's how strongly she feels about this case. And in this clip from the film Valentine Road, she's trying to kind of explain just why she feels so strongly about Brandon.
This is my only tattoo. Obviously, it's a show of support for Brandon. It felt like the right thing to do. I don't know how to explain it. I don't know that I will ever be able to express what it is about this kid that means so much to me. I love him. He's like one of my favorite people on the planet. His spirit and his energy and his... I don't know what it is. And I don't suppose I need to know what it is, but I love him. I think he's fantastic. Every time I look at it, I'm happy.
You admire that in some way, Marta?
I think admiration probably, it's very hard for me to understand why she did that.
Yeah.
But I do understand the connection that you can have when you feel like someone needs to be saved.
Right.
That I totally understand. And that's how she feels. She feels that this child had no one at any point in time who really loved him. And she was going to bear that. She was going to bear that cross. And I feel that I do understand. And I saw it quite a bit. Even in the homeless shelter that I went to, you know, when children don't have anyone, and you work with them on a day-to-day basis, there seem to be two types of people. People that, end up adopting the children and wanting to take them home or do take them home. And there are people who look at it as a 9-to-5 job and have tremendously, carved out boundaries. And there, you know, it takes all types.
Brandon's life story, you spend a lot of time explaining who Brandon is and where he comes from. I mean, he, throughout his story. Parents recovering, his mother, a recovering addict. Not, of course, ever the most stable of home environments. There are addiction issues and domestic violence. His father, Billy, was this erratic guy who shoots his mother in a domestic dispute, breaks his nose for drinking a beer. They were homeless for a time. Here's another clip. You hear Kendra McInerney, who is his mother, and then James Bing, who's his half-brother, talking about really what it was like for Brandon to grow up. Here's another clip from Valentine Road.
My mom was on drugs, like, the whole time I was growing up. Living life of a zombie. Just high all the time.
I moved out when I was, like, 17. I wasn't even 18 yet. I just moved out because we were homeless anyways.
Brandon went to live with Billy at Grandpa's house.
It might not sound good, but it was most likely better for him to be with Billy at that point.
He had Billy up on this high pedestal, and Billy fell off, and he fell off hard and far.
He would seriously take Brandon with him on his drug runs, like when he was smoking crystal meth and stuff, and Brandon would be sitting there in their living room, sleeping. He would, like, crawl under the coffee tables and fall asleep, just to, like, kind of be out of sight of everybody.
There was times when I'd pick Brandon up and his knuckles were sore from being out in the front yard, hitting the tree in the front yard. It would be bloody. He wanted out of the house so bad, and every time he was with me, he was begging me to get a place to live so he could come live with me, because I lived at the rehab for so long, and I couldn't do it.
Tears were coming down his face, and he was saying how, James, don't make me go home, I don't want to go.
And, you know, we all got to leave Billy's situation, and he didn't.
You know, one of the things that becomes kind of a theme in the film, Marta Cunningham, is that, and Robin Bramson says this as much, I won't use the curse word she does, but the adults really screwed up in Brandon's life, but I think you could extend that certainly to Larry's as well. As I said in the introduction, the adults always seem to fail him, and it seemed like it was the kids that you talked to in the film that were the ones you could kind of count on, that really kind of knew the score. This was something that came out in the film.
Yes, without a doubt. I mean, the children had remorse. They had regret. They felt guilty for the way they treated him and teased Larry. They have all of the human emotions that one should go through. And it was pretty astounding to me how the adults in the school didn't seem to feel that. So that was really shocking to me. I mean, as a parent as well, I just felt like, you know, no matter if you agree with who Larry is or not, he was a child. That was really disturbing to me. And the kids got it. Yeah. They were like, okay, we had a problem with Larry and the choice that he made of dressing in this effeminate manner. But we were wrong. The way we treated him, we were wrong, and we feel badly about it. And that was really, I needed to create again a platform for them so they had a voice, because they at 15, 14, 13, they didn't get it. And understandably so, because there was no curriculum. And honestly, as an adult, I didn't understand.
Right.
And it's one of the reasons why I did the film. I really wanted to understand and learn myself, and then use at some point, hopefully, this film can be a teaching tool, because it's an area that we don't know a lot about as a society, not just in this country, but internationally. What does it mean to be transgender? What does it mean to be born as a boy? But actually, I prefer wearing girls' items. I prefer wearing girls' boots. And I prefer makeup, and I prefer being called a girl's name. I mean, that was really a learning curve for me, and I admired his confidence.
Marta Cunningham is with us, director and producer of the documentary film Valentine Road. Next week, she's going to be with us here in Salt Lake City for a free screening of the film, which is part of our Through the Lens series in partnership with the Utah Film Center. It's next Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. For details, go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue our series on documentary films. We have with us the filmmaker Marta Cunningham. We're talking about Valentine Road, a documentary of hers, which premiered at the Sundance Film Festival this year in the U.S. Documentary Competition. We're going to be screening it next week. We'll give you the details about that. Marta Cunningham is joining us today from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. Let's talk about the teachers, Marta Cunningham, because there's an interesting contrast here. Let's start with Dawn Boldrin, Larry's English teacher. She was in the computer class when Larry was shot and killed. She's an interesting character. She had given Larry a dress just days before this shooting. She accepts him. She's there for him, and it has a profound effect, his death, on her. She ends up leaving her job. Talk about Dawn Boldrin, if you would.
Dawn Boldrin is a very interesting character, and she was profoundly damaged by this incident. She has worked through a lot of it since the first time I met her in 2009 by getting, you know, proper help. But I believe that one of the saddest and most tragic things about this event is that these people who witnessed, these children and Dawn included, who witnessed this incident, you know, suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder and didn't get the proper help that they deserved to get and they should have gotten. And Dawn fought that. She realized it and she knew, and to her credit, didn't feel she was ready to go back into the classroom, and really had to relinquish her position because of her situation, because of how she felt about her safety in the classroom. And a lot of kids felt the same way. Marina and Mariah both. Mariah left soon after and moved in with her father in, you know, 60 minutes away. Mm-hmm. And Marina dropped out of school for a period of time and did a homeschooling course and then returned but still hasn't graduated. I mean, these kids were so deeply moved in all the wrong ways. And no one felt that it was their responsibility to help the kids or Dawn. And I really needed to show that. I needed to show and give them a voice and a platform to express themselves. They were so upset and so just really furious. Dawn, I would say, was furious in how she was kind of thrown out with the trash, is what she used to tell me. And I understood that.
I just kept having the flashbacks. I'd be driving and just start crying. I'm just never going to see the world the way I did before February 12th. If I fall and break my leg, easy. I know what the problem is. But with the post-traumatic, you don't know what's going to set it off. My family couldn't handle it. They couldn't handle the anxiety, the crying, the despair. I had overdosed on drugs. I had tried to commit suicide. And I almost did it because I was on life support for 3 days.
It's from the film Valentine Road. So we have Dawn Boldrin on one side, other teachers on the other. I don't want to put it in one side or the other, but representing a different perspective, let's put it that way. What do you make of – let's talk about Shirley Brown. This is one of Larry's grade school teachers. And Larry comes to her – here's another clip. You'll hear Shirley because I think she's such a fascinating character. I don't know what to make of her in some ways. You know, part of – people are going to see her and they're going – some are going to hate her. I think she's really insensitive. But I think she's an important part because she did play a role in this story, certainly in Larry's life. And here she is from the film Valentine Road, Shirley Brown.
I do believe in a heaven and a hell. And I do believe Larry honestly did not even have a clue the consequences of his actions. I relate to Brandon because I could see my own self being in that very same position. I don't know if I would have taken a gun, but a good swift kick in the butt might work really well.
What do you make of Shirley Brown?
I think Shirley Brown is a great example of why we need curriculum in our schools given to our teachers and administrators of what LGBT students need and how to support them. I think she's a fantastic example of why this keeps happening and why it will continue to happen unless we do something about it. And I think that there are a lot of people who relate to Shirley.
Yeah.
So if you relate to Shirley, then, you know, maybe you're not getting the proper education, and we need to educate people. This is an educational issue to me.
And the question kept coming up, and it wasn't just expressed by Shirley Brown, but there's others, another teacher in particular, who said, I think outrageously, that if Larry had been her student, that wouldn't have happened. But she says the question is raised whether the teacher should have tempered Larry's behavior, because the parents weren't, you know, whether the teacher should have really stopped him, you know, how much you should moderate that behavior, how much leeway you give to someone like Larry, you know, how much do you give into the sort of the taboos of the culture? Do you have to take this baby steps? I mean, all these questions were raised by Shirley Brown in some ways.
I agree. And it's the reason why she's in the film, because I think it's very important that we arm our teachers with information, educational tools. When a child decides to dress in a feminine manner, that's a boy, he's within his rights. It's a state law. So we need to respect the law. But how do we then educate the teachers? How do we educate the students? And that didn't happen.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about, this wasn't something you chose to deal with directly in the film, but I did wonder, what was it that Robin Bransom and Scott Whippet, what did they think about Larry? Because their defense strategy, I think it could be fair to say it was somewhat controversial, and we'll talk about that. But what did Robin and Scott make of Larry? Not just Brandon, their defendant, but how were they thinking about Larry? Where Larry fit in all of this?
Well, in court, they were very clear that they felt that Larry was a provocateur, that he was sexually harassing Brandon.
Yeah.
Many people call that the gay panic defense, which is illegal in the state of California.
I want to play a clip because one of their defense experts is this Dr. Donald Hoagland, this forensic scientist. I'm not sure exactly what his title is, but, you know, the question is whether or not Larry was bullying Brandon, harassing Brandon. Here's Dr. Hoagland from the film Valentine Road.
What Larry was doing to Brandon was an extreme form of bullying. It was an extreme form of sexual harassment. When playing basketball at lunch, Larry had wobbled onto the court, interrupted the game in front of all Brandon's basketball buddies and asked him if he would be his Valentine. To have any guy ask you that in front of all your peers, but to have a guy who's wearing high heels and makeup, that would be like the ultimate humiliation. It was very disturbing to all the boys, and so they, you know, kind of talked about it in a guy way, macho way. It's bad enough to have this kid who wears girls' clothes, you know, breaking all the rules, but then, you know, guys don't hit on guys. If you want to really insult a guy, you call him gay. Brandon was thinking that he needed to get rid of Larry. He needed to save everyone from this, you know, this scourge that had come up on the school.
So, Marta Cunningham, how do you reconcile, you know, this well-meaning, sensitive defense team, Robin and Scott, with the strategy that they tried to mount?
Well, I don't think it's my place to judge their strategy. I just wanted to show it. I thought it was very interesting that they chose, and it happens in courtrooms all over America. You know, even in rape cases, they blame women for not wearing underwear or not wearing pantyhose or being in the wrong place at the wrong time. So it's not new. It's nothing new to blame the victim. But I did want to show that. I thought it was it was a choice. It was their choice to make sure that everyone knew, and not just the jurors, but, you know, they went on the record. They also did interviews with 2020, that everyone knew that Larry was the provocateur and brought on basically his own death, in a manner of speaking, by saying that he was sexually harassing and bullying Brandon. It's a viewpoint. It's a choice.
And you want to let people judge it for themselves, it sounds like.
I do. It's not, I mean, my goal as a filmmaker is to stay as neutral as possible. I mean, it's really important that I'm not here on a soap opera, you know, box telling people what to do. That's not my job. My job is to bear witness and get as close to the truth as possible, and also to make sure that the people that are involved in this story have a voice.
It's interesting how the jury becomes a character, almost a collective character, or certainly a small group of women. To talk about that, because the jurors. I don't want to give too much away about what happens in the trial, but the jurors become a part of the film in an interesting way.
They do. They're very interesting, the three women that wanted to, you know, share their feelings about why they chose manslaughter instead of murder. I think that the three that I interviewed really were emotionally attached to Brandon. The way they spoke about him was like a family member. Mm-hmm. That's what I witnessed. And when I spoke to them, even recently I spoke to one of them, they were really hoping that this film would help Brandon in any way that they could. They wanted to help him.
But all of their concerns were based on their own discomfort of Larry dressing like a girl and being in people's face. The jury, Shirley Brown, others believed this was the consequence of Larry's behavior.
That's correct. And I'm not quite sure what the behavior is that they felt justified being killed. But I do know that the jurors, you know, it is an us and them situation in a courtroom.
Right.
And they just parroted what the defense said.
There's a moment in the film where one of the young people you talk to, and it's early on, she says that people have learned a lot about themselves through this. What do you think a film like this, because in many, you don't resolve it. You don't tie up anything in a tidy end. We're all left to sort of make these decisions for ourselves. What do you think we can learn about ourselves in a story like this?
Well, I think Mae Fox says it best, and it is to be more accepting and to understand that these things will keep happening unless we decide as a country to educate ourselves. We can't keep ignoring that our children are in great need. And when we see things like this happening, because this escalated, this didn't happen overnight.
Right.
You know, this incident was because of an escalation. And if the children didn't feel comfortable enough to speak to adults about it, then that's the adults' fault in this situation. And it happens in every school, really. There's always going to be a situation where someone's not getting what they need. And a lot of it has to do and happens in the LGBT community. You know, their suicide rates are higher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a tremendous bullying. The statistics are out of control. The more research I did about children who are like Larry or on the spectrum, I felt that the stats were so high. How is this not a national crisis? This is an epidemic, and we need to do something about it. And we need to educate kids like Brandon so they feel comfortable in their own skin and they're not feeling insecure about who they are.
Yeah, Mae Fox says, she says, we bring our intolerance with us wherever we go. She sort of
That's
implicates,
correct.
We're all implicated in some ways in this story.
We are. And that's why she's one of the last people to speak in the film, because I do believe that's true. And I educated myself by doing this film, by hanging out with kids. You know, one of my favorite characters in the film is Marina. And, you know, for the first hour that I spoke to Marina, I thought she was a boy. I had no idea she was a girl. And these kids are feeling very comfortable in themselves at early ages. and they're expressing themselves in different ways than we did. Is it going to hurt anyone? No. Was she hurting anyone by chopping off all her hair and dressing like how we usually typically see boys?
Yeah.
No, she's not. So we need to change as a society because these kids are happy. She's happy.
I think she tells Dawn, Marina tells Dawn, that the day after, or certainly right around that time when Larry was killed, was the first time she dressed as a boy. So she took courage from that horrible story.
It did. Exactly. And she came out to her parents the day of the murder. After witnessing that, she came out. So that tells you the strength and the courage and the confidence that these kids have in themselves at 13, 14 years old. So we need to create a support system for them.
Mm. She said, "I feel like a ghost." Marina does at one moment
after
in the
watching that. It's post-traumatic stress disorder that she also suffers from.
Yeah. Let me ask you finally, how are people reacting to the to
We're
the
having an incredible, ride from this. I mean, this film had to be made. And the communities that are coming out and supporting this film range from every walk of life. I've had kids actually come up to me crying, Mormons in Park City who came from Salt Lake City and said, "We're going to bring this back to our community and tell them why they need to change their ideas about the LGBT community." Teenagers came up to me crying. And you know, that means so much to me because it's the reason why I did the film.
It's Marta Cunningham, director, producer of the documentary Valentine Road. Next Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock, Radio West and the Utah Film Center is presenting a free screening, the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. Go to our website for the particulars. Marta Cunningham, we'll see you next week. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.